The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading articles to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article from the Religion News Service that was published on September 6th and written by Yonat Shimron. Center honoring trailblazing lawyer, civil rights activist, and priest opens in Durham, North Carolina. In 2018, the Episcopal Church named the Reverend Pauli Murray, its first black female priest, a saint. In 2021, a documentary film, My Name is Pauli Murray, premiered at Sundance and was later acquired by Amazon. In 2023, the U.S. Mint chose the priest, who was also a lawyer and civil rights activist, as one of five honorees to appear in a special edition of the U.S. Quarter. Now the childhood home where Murray grew up in Durham, North Carolina, officially opens after 12 years of renovation. Known as the Pauli Murray Center for Historic and Social Justice, it is yet another site in the multiplying spaces where the trailblazing activist is finally being recognized. The refurbished two-story clapboard home, built by Murray's grandfather in 1898, was designated a National Historic Landmark in 2016. With donations of $1.2 million for its rehabilitation, it will now anchor a set of initiatives its governing nonprofit board hopes will further the kind of progressive social causes that Murray championed before dying in 1985. We will invite people into this space to learn about the life, legacy, and work of the Reverend Dr. Pauli Murray, said Angela Thorpe Mason, the center's executive director. But we're using that as a means to invite and catalyze people to move contemporary social change work forward in their communities. Murray may be best known as a civil rights activist who helped shape the legal argument for the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling. In a final law school paper at Howard University School of Law, Murray wrote that separate could never be equal. In 1951, Murray published a book on segregation laws that Thurgood Marshall, who argued the Brown case before the High Court and later became a Supreme Court justice himself, credited as the Bible of the Civil Rights Movement. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, before she became a Supreme Court justice, also credited Murray's arguments. Ginsburg named Murray in a legal brief she wrote while arguing a 1971 Supreme Court case that banned gender discrimination based on the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Not content with a rich legal career, Murray was good friends with former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. The civil rights leader applied to General Theological Seminary in New York City and was ordained a priest in 1977 at the age of 66. Here's a person with a degree from a seminary who's been an Episcopalian all her life and who is a brilliant professional. And she never really got to have a congregation or make the kind of impact she could have made if she had had the opportunity to really be the rector and all, said her niece, Rosita Stevens Holsey, of Upper Marlboro, Maryland, one of Murray's last surviving relatives. Many scholars now recognize that Murray was also gender nonconforming. Murray sometimes presented as a woman and sometimes as a man. Feeling trapped in a woman's body, Murray begged doctors to prescribe hormone therapy. They refused. In the new center, Murray is referred to with they-them pronouns. The newly opened center, which will conduct tours and hold lectures and film screenings, will also honor Murray's struggles with gender and sex. In partnership with the North Carolina Bar Foundation, the center will provide pro bono legal services as part of a name and gender Marker Change Clinic. Law students and attorneys will provide pro bono services to members of our LGBTQ community as they seek to change their names and genders, which is oftentimes a very complicated and long and expensive legal process, Mason said. This will illuminate Pauli's work as an attorney, as a member of the LGBTQ community, as somebody who, in the 2020s, we understand as gender nonconforming. The center sits in Durham's West End, a historically black working-class neighborhood that abuts Durham's largest cemetery. Until a few years ago, many of the homes there, including the Pauli Murray House, were slated for demolition. Though technically abandoned, squatters were living in the house until 2011, when a coalition, the Central Durham Quality of Life Project, saved it. The center was officially created a year later. Born in Baltimore, Murray wrote lovingly about the Durham House in her 1956 autobiographical book, Proud Shoes. Murray moved into the home in 1914 at the age of four, after their mother died. The second story has two bedrooms, one for Murray's grandparents and the other that Murray shared with their aunt, Pauline Fitzgerald Dame. The family attended St. Titus Episcopal Church, a historically black church, about 2 miles east. The center has a few of Murray's personal belongings, but it does feature one of Murray's three typewriters. One person plus one typewriter constitutes a movement, Murray once wrote. Stevens Holsey, Murray's niece, said she was thankful that Murray grew up with her grandparents and aunt in the Jim Crow South. What Aunt Pauli observed here, what she lived through here, what she liked and didn't like from her experiences here, made her the person that she was, said Stevens Holsey, who wrote, Pauli Murray, the life of a pioneering feminist and civil rights activist, a young adult biography of her aunt. I thank Durham for that because she wouldn't have been, in my mind, the advocate, the legal theorist, the person that she was, had she not lived here and gone through what she did. Now an article published by the Associated Press and written by Stella McCartney and Kareem Chehayeb. Iraqi women fear rise in child marriages as lawmakers consider giving conservative clerics more say. Erbil, Iraq. Shema Sadoun is haunted by her memory of being forced into an abusive marriage to a 39-year-old man just after she turned 13. Her impoverished family near the southern Iraqi city of Basra hoped that the dowry of gold and money would help improve their circumstances. Her husband presented a blood-stained piece of linen to prove her virginity after their wedding night. I was expected to be a wife and mother while I was still a child myself. No child or teenager should be forced to live what I have lived and experienced, said Sadoun, who divorced her husband when she was 30 and is now 44. Sadoun's marriage was illegal, though a judge who was related to the husband signed off on it. Iraqi law sets 18 as the minimum age of marriage in most cases. But such child marriages of girls might be state-sanctioned soon. Iraq's parliament is considering a controversial legal change that would give religious authorities more power over family law matters, a move that rights groups and opponents warn could open the door to the marriage of girls as young as 9. Law would let clerics rule how a young girl can be married. The push for the changes come mainly from powerful Shiite Muslim political factions, backed by religious leaders that have increasingly campaigned against what they describe as the West imposing its cultural norms on Muslim-majority Iraq. In April, the parliament passed a harsh anti-LGBTQ plus law. The proposed amendments would allow Iraqis to turn to religious courts on issues of family law, including marriage, which currently are the sole domain of civil courts. That would let clerics rule according to their interpretation of Sharia or Islamic law, as opposed to national laws. Some clerics interpret Sharia to allow marriage of girls in their early teens, or as young as 9, under the Jafari of Islamic law, followed by many Shiite religious authorities in Iraq. Many Iraqi women have reacted with horror, holding protests outside parliament and campaigning against the changes on social media. Legislating a law that brings back the country 1,500 years is a shameful matter, and we will keep rejecting it until the last breath, Heba El Dabouni, an activist among dozens at a protest in August, told the Associated Press. The Iraqi parliament's job is to pass laws that will raise the standards of society. Conservative legislators say the changes give people a choice whether to use civil or religious law, and argue they are defending families from secular Western influences. Human Rights Watch Iraq researcher Sarah Sandbar said the changes prioritize the husband's preference. So, yes, it's giving a choice, but it's giving a choice to men first and foremost. Not all religious leaders are on board. The often furious debate has spilled into Iraqi media, even among clerics. On one recent news show, a Sunni cleric argued against a younger marriage age, calling it damaging to girls and saying there was no problem under Islam with the existing laws. In a lecture posted on social media, Shiite cleric Rashid al-Husseini insisted Sharia allows marrying a 9-year-old girl. But in practice, is that something that actually happens? It might be 0% or 1% of cases, he said. The proposed amendments are backed by most Shiite legislators in a bloc called the Coordination Framework that holds a parliament majority. But disputes continue over the draft. Parliament was meant to hold an initial vote on the law Tuesday, but could not reach a quorum and had to postpone it. Iraq's personal status law, passed in 1959, is broadly perceived as a strong foundation, largely protecting women and girls' rights. It set the legal marriage age at 18, though it allows girls as young as 15 to marry with parental consent and medical proof that the girl has hit puberty and is menstruating. Marriages outside state courts were forbidden. Still, enforcement is lax. Individual judges sometimes approve younger marriages, whether because of corruption or because the marriage has already taken place informally. Parliamentarian Raed al-Maliki, who presented the proposed amendments, said the state would still provide protections and that discussions were still taking place about a minimum marriage age. The age will be very close to the current law, al-Maliki told the AP without elaborating. Iraqi women are leading the fight against the changes. Al-Maliki and other proponents depict the changes as a defense against Western secularism. He said the original law was influenced by communist and Ba'athist, the latter in reference to the secular pan-Arab nationalist party that ruled the country with an iron fist from 1968 until its rule under Saddam Hussein was toppled in the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. In the West, they take children away from their parents for the simplest reasons and accuse them of violence. Then they change their culture and create homosexuals out of them, al-Maliki said, referring to Iraq's law passed in April that criminalized same-sex relations and the promotion of LGBTQ+ rights. We cannot imitate that or consider it as development. Criticism of Western culture has gained new strength since the latest Israel-Hamas war broke out, with most Iraqis sympathizing with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Many see statements about human rights by the U.S. and others as hypocritical because of their support of Israel's campaign in Gaza, which has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians. But the most vocal opponents of the changes are Iraqi women, said Sanbar of Human Rights Watch. It speaks volumes to the fact that this is what Iraqi women want, not foreign organizations dictating what Iraq needs to do, she said. This wasn't the first such set of amendments to be proposed over the past decade, but now Shiite parties are more unified behind them. Harith Hossam, a non-resident fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Center, says Shiite parties previously had different priorities, focused on the many conflicts rocking the country the past two decades. Now there is sort of a consensus among them on cultural issues, he said, adding that the new amendments would create institutionalized sectarianism in Iraq and could weaken civil courts. When they say it is the right of religious officials to handle marriage, inheritance, divorce, and the court cannot challenge this, you create two parallel authorities, Hassan said. This will create confusion in the country. Sadoun, who now lives in Erbil, in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region, said she fears for women and girls in Iraq. The new amendments in the personal status law will destroy the future of many little girls and many generations, she said. Now an article published by the Religion News Service on September 6th and written by Jeffrey Salkin. Rabbi Irving Greenberg's life work celebrating Judaism summed up in new book. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg is my oldest rabbi friend. First, this modern Orthodox rabbi was one of the first rabbis to really touch my life and to engage me in what my Protestant colleagues would call formation. Rabbi Yitz Greenberg was a congregational rabbi in Riverdale, New York, the founder of the Jewish Studies Program at City College of New York, and the creator of the Center for Learning and Leadership, CLAL, a think tank for Jewish pluralism and intra-Jewish conversation. I first met Rabbi Greenberg and his wife, Blue Greenberg, the major Jewish feminist leader, when he engaged me to work with a bunch of modern Orthodox teenagers on a CLAL retreat. That encounter with Rabbi Greenberg, whom I would come to know as Yitz or Rabbi Yitz, changed my perception of Orthodox Jews and Orthodox Judaism. It made me more open to seeing the Jews as a unified people and not just a discrete collection of ideologies. This Orthodox rabbi helped shape the worldview of the Reform rabbi. His vision of an observant Judaism that was open to the world and freely encountered the world moved me, so much so that decades later, I would become a regular participant in the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, founded by Rabbi Greenberg's colleague, the late Rabbi David Hartman, also an Orthodox rabbi, and like Yitz, also a rebel. The second way in which Rabbi Yitz is my oldest friend in the rabbinate. He is 91 years old, and he has just published his magnum opus, his masterwork, the culmination of everything that he has taught for so long, The Triumph of Life, a Narrative Theology of Judaism. This is the book that Yitz's students and, frankly, the Jewish world have been waiting for more than half a century. Yitz's central idea: Judaism is a religion of life that centers on life, in which every commandment affirms life and moves the human being toward higher affirmations of life and ultimately toward God. The essence of the commandments is for us to live through them. When there is a choice between life, health, and a religious duty, the Jew must set aside almost any religious duty in order to save life. Yeats writes, God wants the forces of order and life to win out. God asks humans to live in such a way that, in their actions, they join in on the side of order and against chaos, on the side of life and against non-life and death, on the side of increasing quality of life and against dumbing it down. The meaning of the covenant between God and the Jewish people is that we might repair the world, tikkun olam, to perfect the world and to bring it closer to God's ultimate vision of human perfection. At every stage of Jewish life, we are called upon to see our actions and the areas in which we play them out as microcosms of that perfect world. The Torah works with microcosms, inner circles that may be expanded. The ancient temple is the microcosm for space. Shabbat is the inner circle for time. The Jewish people is the inner circle for humanity. In time, the inner circles will expand and include all those in the outer circle. Thus, holy space will encompass Jerusalem, then Israel, and eventually the whole world. Shabbat will grow until the whole week is in the zone of full life. The holy people will expand until all of humanity are holy people. For Yeats, what teaching forms the moral core of Judaism? The great principle underlying the ethic of the Torah is that every human being, regardless of gender, race, skin color, nationality, or religion, is created in the image of God and endowed accordingly with three fundamental dignities: infinite value, equality, and uniqueness. Infinite value and infinite worth. In the movie The Monuments Men, a team goes into Europe during World War II to find and save valuable pieces of art that the Nazis had stolen and threatened to destroy. I liked the movie. I greatly disliked the story. People worked admirably to save works of art. They labored far less admirably to save the real works of art, God's children, God's creation. In Yeats's words, what is the value of an image of a human being? That is, of a work of art created by a classic artist? Multiple Picassos have sold for over $100 million. In 1990, the world record for a painting at that time was set when won by Van Gogh, itself literally an image of a man, the portrait of Dr. Gachet, was sold for $82.5 million to a Japanese insurance company. This is precisely what formed Rav Yeats's lifelong involvement in Holocaust remembrance. The Nazis incinerated Jewish children alive in order to economize on the cost of gas. The Holocaust was a unique assault on the divine image. Therefore, anything and everything that we can do to uphold the divine image is sacred work. Upholding the divine image, that is our task, even as the divine seems to fade. In one of his most profound moves, Rabbi Yeats demarcates three eras in Jewish history: the biblical, the rabbinic, and the modern. In each era, the presence of God changes. God is no longer manifest as God was in biblical times. God withdraws into the divine self to allow greater human activism. His words, God is now totally hidden in natural laws and material processes. Today, God makes more miracles than ever, but only through human agency. Our unlocking the miraculous powers in physical and biological matter that only we can exercise by understanding and utilizing nature's laws. Once upon a time, people lived lives of faith, sometimes interrupted by moments of doubt. Today, people live lives of doubt, sometimes interrupted by moments of faith. The triumph of life is simply that, a triumph of the Jewish mind and spirit. It is a remarkable tribute to the life work of one of contemporary Judaism's most treasured and cherished voices. That it emerges when he is 91 years old is itself a blessing. First, that he had the blessing to see his work come to light, and second, that in the words of Deuteronomy in describing the elderly Moses, his eye is undimmed, and his spirit as strong today as it was decades ago. More than that, my friendship with Yitzhak Blue has enriched my life immeasurably. Their hospitality to me, with the accompanying conversations about the challenges of modernity and how our respective Judaisms confront those challenges, have become the true highlight of my July sojourns in Jerusalem. Years ago, he said something that has always stayed with me, the job description of the Jews in three P's. The Jews are pedagogues, teaching the idea of the infinite value, equality, and uniqueness of every human being, even and especially in times and places when this idea would have been considered absurd. The Jews are paradigms, a working model to show how we can perfect the world. A working model is not perfect, but nevertheless, the Jews can still be a model. The Jews are partners, working with those of other faiths and even no faith in perfecting the world. It is only now, in a time of increased religious dialogue, that such a partnership is even thinkable. One last thing. It is not only that Rabbi Yitz Greenberg at 91 is my oldest friend in the rabbinate, or anywhere else for that matter. It is far more than that. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Please join me again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.